Discover the easiest way to juggle binging on content you love while doing your favorite activities with Audible. Listen to Audible's unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more. Allows users to experience new journeys without having to drop what they're doing. Any book can be heard on the go. I'm a Clancy guy, but also I love hearing about other people's journeys in life. It's a great source of motivation for me while I'm doing things that I love, like hiking, or riding a bike, or on a long drive to and from work. By becoming a member, users receive one free audiobook a month. Exclusive sales and 30% off regularly priced audiobooks. Plus, your books are yours to keep. With Audible, you can go back and re-listen at any time, even if you cancel your membership. That doesn't sound good enough. Audible is offering listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/allball and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a title for free and start listening. It's really that easy. Just go to audible.com/allball or text allball to 500-500 to get started today. Hey, it's Doug Gottlieb. Welcome into the All Ball Podcast. Man, there's been so much great feedback over our long interview with Jay Billis, part one, part two, which of course is still available on just wherever you download this podcast. Type in Jay Billis, Doug Gottlieb, or Jay Billis All Ball, and you'll find part one, part two. I want to welcome you in, remind you that the Doug Gottlieb Show runs daily from 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific Time on Fox Sports Radio, foxsportsradio.com. And, oh yeah, by the way, if you missed it, or do you have satellite radio? And our satellite station, XM83, right now is running TV programming instead. So you miss it, you're like, man, I really like to hear your radio show. A condensed version, all sorts of versions, individual interviews. Wherever you download iTunes, just type in Doug Gottlieb Show and you will have it. This week's guest, and look, I could get into the ACC and the Big East and the Big 12 and all releasing schedules, or I'll give you a second on Russell Westbrook's injury and the subsequent surgery, and he's going to be out for the preseason. Give you some thoughts on that in a moment. But for the most part, we're getting you ready for the upcoming NBA and college basketball season. We'll look forward to the college basketball schedule in the coming weeks, but I don't want to waste our time. We got a great guest. His name is Scott Brooks. Scotty, of course, most of you remember, was the head coach of the Oklahoma City Thunder and is now the head coach of the Washington Wizards. But I, having known Scott for, wow, now you start to like track yourself, like how long have I known him? I'm going to go about 30 years, a little bit more than 30 years. I can honestly tell you that he's an incredibly interesting guy, also a great dude, but super, super interesting. His life story is one that I'm not sure most of you know, and I want him to tell it. And then we'll get to little side stories about making the NBA from being a CBA player, making his way first to UC Irvine. UC Irvine was super, super talented back in the day. I used to go to their basketball camps and watch them play at Crawford Hall. My dad was an assistant at Long Beach State before they lost their job, and then watching UC Irvine play. So I can remember what it was like to watch the Aniers and watch Scotty Brooks, but how he made it from there to the NBA, playing for over a decade in the NBA, to becoming an assistant. Also, he was a head coach in the ABA. I want to get to him with that. Talk about playing with the Sixers with Charles Barkley, what his interactions and ultimately his friendship was with Charles Barkley was like, winning an NBA title with the Houston Rockets, becoming an NBA assistant, coaching with the Supersonics and then Thunder, and then they... PJ gets fired and he gets the job, and then, you know, going to the NBA finals and losing in the NBA finals and having all the injuries in a couple of subsequent years and never getting back to that moment before losing his job, what it was like to lose a job, to sit out, to wait, why the Wizards, and how can he fix the Wizards. Man, there's a lot to get to. So that's kind of the ultimate teaser. Let me first start with this thoughts, because you're going to hear from Scotty on what it's like to coach Russell Westbrook. His honest perspective, I think you'll enjoy it. So Russell had his knee cleaned up. And remember, this is a guy who was a torn meniscus, Patrick Beverley, in kind of like a Scotty Brooks type of way. We're going to talk about this. The backup point guard, you have to be just tougher than a $2 steak. You know, you got to be willing to put your nose in there. Maybe get a steal when a guy goes to call a timeout at midcourt. That's when Patrick Beverley mistakenly bumped into Russell Westbrook's knee. Russell tore his meniscus. And then, of course, the first surgery didn't take. And that next year was honestly what led to Scotty Brooks' dismissal as head coach of the Oklahoma City Thunder. I think the fear with Russell is it's not that he plays hard and that his knee won't be fine when he comes back. plenty of guys have had their knees scoped. Plenty of athletic guys have had their knees scoped, and we're still very, very good athletes. The fear, though, is that anytime you go in on somebody's knee, anytime you go in and fix even an elbow with Tommy John, the more you go in, you run the risk of infection, you run the risk of you not being the same, and of chronic pain, and of a shortening of career and a lessening of athleticism. And Russell Westbrook is arguably the best athlete, great of the great players in all sports. He might be the best overall athlete when you combine speed, quickness, toughness, lateral and vertical athleticism. I mean, he's got it all. And so does this slow him down even a notch and progressively more so? And does it expose the fact that his jump shot has never really been a consistent weapon from beyond three-point range? I think that would be my fear. Also, if you remember, the argument for Paul George staying in Oklahoma City and the argument that I've made for Oklahoma City being the second-best team in the West is, look, they're going to be better together the second time around. Another full training camp, another year of Russ and PG and others playing together. Frankly, they set themselves up very nicely with Dennis Schroeder, who will get a chance to play major minutes early on. I like Schroeder as a backup point guard more than a starter. But I think it's going to be fascinating to see if the consistency and continuity, minus obviously Carmelo Anthony, but the addition by subtraction of losing Carmelo Anthony and the consistency and continuity, keeping the same coach, keeping most of the same roster, adding in Dennis Schroeder, if that ultimately benefits the Oklahoma City Thunder now that they don't have Russell Westbrook for training camp. Kind of interesting, right? All right, we'll keep you updated on that, get you ready for the NBA season in the coming weeks. I thought this would whet your appetite, though. Let's get to our discussion with Scott Brooks. It's a two-parter, and I think you'll enjoy it. If you have any questions or comments, at Gottlieb Show is the Twitter handle. So let's welcome in the head coach of the Washington Wizards, a longtime friend, Scott Brooks. All right, let's welcome into the All Ball Podcast the head coach of the Washington Wizards, Scott Brooks, joins us. And Scott, look, I want to get to the Wiz. I want to get to your time with the Thunder. But I want to start with you as a person and you as a player, because when I first got a chance to watch you is when you're at UC Irvine, averaging like 23, 24 a game, playing at Crawford Hall. And I think you played a year or two at the Bren Center. I think you played all at the Bren Center, maybe.
Yes, opened up the Bren Center.
There's a lot I want to get into, but you grew up in like the Sacramento area, right? Where's French Camp?
Well, it's about 60 miles south of San Francisco. I was born in French Camp, moved at a young age about maybe 5 or 6 miles south to a small town in Lathrop. Youngest of seven. My father left when I was two. Never did see from him or heard from him. No child support, no nothing. My mom raised us on her own, along with some governmental aid until I was about 7 years old. And then she decided, you know what, no more help from the government. We're going to do it as a family. And that's when we started picking walnuts and topping onions on the weekends just to make ends meet.
No way. So give me the oldest to you being the youngest, boy, girl.
Three older brothers, three older sisters. My oldest sister is almost 64, and I'm 53, and three older brothers and three older sisters.
Okay, so seven people, single mother, and you guys kind of all picked up, everybody had a job. You really did pick walnuts and do what with onions?
Top onions, you know, you top them, you put them in the sack, and you move on to the next. You can't do with onions, walnuts, you know, three buckets to a sack, and you didn't get paid a lot of sack, but you got paid enough. At the end of the day, we did it. That's the only way we had to do it. We had no other choice. You know, it was tough. I have two kids, and you know, I say it all the time. I don't know how my mom did it. I really don't know how my mom did it. My wife and I, sometimes we struggle handling the schedules of two kids, and let alone seven all by herself. You know, God bless her. She was incredible. She was my hero. I couldn't have ever asked for a better mom and a better role model than I had.
So, when did you always hoop? Because I mean, for people who don't, and it's really interesting, you know, like there's a there's a disconnect between sometimes between fans and the reality of basketball. Like, you were a great athlete, a great scorer, and it's, you know, how you made it in college, and then you obviously had to find a role in the NBA. And of course, then, you know, you went to coaching, and you had to find a way to, you were on a staff and then became a head coach, and then just kind of like the ultimate survivor. But I think people will always underestimate your athletic ability just because, you know, you're 5'11 white dude. Were you always like athletically talented? No, I'm being like, we're just being honest here, right? Like, that's just, yeah. You know, like 5'11 white dude walks in the gym, everybody's shooter, right? And you were a great shooter, but there's more to it than that. So, like, were you a good athlete in everything? Did you always hoop? Like, what was it like growing up when, you know, you got six brothers and sisters and you're the youngest? What was your athletic career like?
Oh, you know what? I played just about everything growing up. I loved to compete. You have to compete. You get beat up quite a bit. And my mom never babied me, and never, at least I like to think that my brothers and sisters disagree with me on that. But I feel like, you know, I've always been a pretty good athlete. I was able to do a lot of things with my speed. But I love baseball. I love football. I love soccer. I loved it all. I just love to compete. And I think that's the thing that I always try to instill into my team, that you got to go out there and compete. That's what you got to love to do. And I've always loved it growing up.
All right. So you go to Manteca High School, right? Or no, so East Union High School, which is in Manteca, California. Okay, that's
yes.
Around the Sacramento area. How'd you come to sign at TCU?
Well, quite frankly, there was no other options. I wanted to go to UOP. My high school coach, who was like my father's figure, Bill Stricker, played at UOP, played overseas a little bit, but he was my role model. I wanted to follow his footsteps, but they said I wasn't good enough, I wasn't quick enough, I wasn't tall enough to go to UOP and get a scholarship, and I couldn't afford college. Nobody in my family went to college. I didn't really know much about college, but my high school coach guided me, and fortunately for me, one of the TCU's former assistants left the staff to be next to his mother that was not doing well, and started coaching in a local high school in Ceres, not too far from Manteca, and he spotted me, and he called up TCU's coach, and he says, "Hey, you got to give this Brooks kid a scholarship." The coach said, "Okay, I will." So he called me the next day and offered me a scholarship sight unseen. That's how it was, and you know, I'm thankful for it, because I wouldn't have been able to get to college and go to college without a basketball athletic scholarship.
So you go to TCU, and what was your freshman year like?
You know, I had a decent freshman year. It was the first time away from home. So I struggled a bit there. Homesick. I was lovesick. My girlfriend, which, you know, fortunately for me, I ended up marrying her, and I've been married for 25 years. And so that was one of the reasons why I decided to leave TCU and go to UC Irvine or through a junior college. But it was good. You know, the conference was great. Phi Slamma Jamma, Olajuwon in Houston, Joe Klein in Arkansas, and SMU had John Konkak. I think it had three or four top 20 teams in the conference, and I had great teammates. Jamie Dixon was my teammate. Now he's the coach at TCU now. Dennis Nutt was a teammate and a great player. I had just a lot of teammates. I had a lot of fun, but it wasn't for me. I just felt like I had to go and try something else, and I'm glad it worked out, because I had a great time at UC Irvine.
Okay, wait. So you came home, though, because in addition to being homesick, because of your girlfriend who became your wife, right? So this wasn't one of those, like, people always say, like, don't follow the girl. There's plenty of girls, but this actually worked out for you.
Yeah, you know what? I'm not embarrassed, but it was a little. My mom was not happy with me. My mom, oh my gosh, my mom was, I didn't think she talked to me for like 2 months. She was so disappointed in me, because she thought, you know, I would never get a scholarship again. I would never go to college again. But yeah, it was a long ways from home. And I just felt that there was something better for me out there. And like I said, I'm glad I did it, because I really, really enjoyed my time at UC Irvine. What a great university, academically, athletically. It really helped me become a man and become the athlete and then player that I became.
Okay, so but and you went to junior college in between, and you played at junior college though, right?
Yeah, you know what? I did. They just won the state championship, San Joaquin Delta Junior College. Rob DeWitt was the coach. They had a really good team. Obviously, to win the California state championship was a big deal. Junior college basketball in California was high level. So they had one player that left, and he was the guard and the point guard. So it was a perfect position for me to be, and I played there, and we were number one just about most of the season. We go to the tournament, ranked number one, play the 16th ranked team, Riverside, and we end up getting upset. So it was a disappointing finish to my junior college career, but neither there. I really loved it. It was a great opportunity. It gave me an opportunity to get to Irvine.
So you go to UC Irvine, and what I think people like, I people nationally have no idea about the amount of talent that you got that you guys had there. Like, it was really like Bill Mulligan did a great job, not just evaluating and but recruiting and landing kind of all this talent. So you get there, what, 85, 86? Who was on your team?
Yes, we had four NBA players that made the NBA on my team my junior year, mid major. And what's crazy, Coach Mulligan kicked off two other guys who played in the NBA a long time. Ronnie Granderson, I think he played 6-7 years in the NBA, and Tom Tolbert played, I don't know, 7 or 8 or 9 years in the NBA. And we would have had six NBA players on one mid-major school. And what a great team we had. We beat UNLV twice that year when they were ranked in the top five. Just a great opportunity. He's a great recruiter. The funny thing is how he recruited me. He went to the state tournament. The state tournament was so backed up, it was 2 hours late. And he happened to sit next to Jim Killingsworth, who was TCU's coach. And they were good friends from all the battles they had at junior college. And he looked at Coach Mulligan and said, "Hey, you got to recruit this Brooks kid. I had him for a year. I was so disappointed that he left. And it really, it bothered me. But I'll tell you what, recruit him. He's really good." So fast forward, Mulligan does not stay for our game because it was so late. I think we started like at 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night. And he calls me the next day and offered me a scholarship sight unseen. So what a way to get two college scholarships sight unseen.
So so you show up on campus there. And did you know that UCI was that loaded? Like, you had any idea Todd Murphy and Johnny Rogers were that good?
I had no idea how good we were. I just thought, I thought we were this great university close to Newport Beach, a beautiful campus, great teammates. I just thought we were just going to have a lot of fun. They were all kind of like, they all kind of looked like they were just off the beach. But they were competitive. I just thought, man, I got to step up my game. These guys compete, and they're athletic, and they're big, and they're strong, they're quick, and they can shoot. Johnny Rogers, Todd Murphy, they're great shooters in their 6'9", 6'10", 6'11" range. And I'm thinking, man, I've never seen guys this big could shoot the ball and run the floor and move around like they did. But I knew that we were really good. And like I said, what a great experience I had. And Coach Mulligan had a great run. Kevin McGee was the all-time best player. I mean, it's a shame that, he never played in the NBA because he was by far the best player ever to play at Irvine. Ben McDonald, Bob Thornton, they just had Wayne Ingles. They had a lot of NBA players during like a 3 or 4 year stretch there, but it was because of Mulligan. What a great recruiter.
Okay, so what was he like as a coach, though? Because, again, there were all those players, and it seemed like every year you guys would beat UNLV, and yet you couldn't get to the tournament because there was only UNLV would get there, and the league was really good. Was he not that good a coach? I mean, you went, like, your first year, you averaged, like, 10 a game. I remember your second year, you averaged, like, 23 a game. Did you guys not play defense? Like, what was missing there?
Yeah, you know what? Great coach, great recruiter, fun guy. I mean, crazy, but in a fun way. He wanted to, he taught me a lot about offensive basketball. Our defense, we weren't as good as we needed to be, and that was obvious. But our offense, we were way ahead. He was a pro offensive coach before any college coach played that way. We were fast breaking. We were shooting quick. We were shooting threes my senior year at a pretty good clip. But he was, I thought he was very, he's very animated, and he was loved by the players because he was a lot of fun, fiery, our halftime, legendary sessions. You know, things were thrown, chairs were thrown, and it was a fun time to be an anteater.
Okay, so you get done playing, you average about 23.8, almost 24 points a game. And by the way, like, you get, people should go back and look, as you point out, you guys shot twice as many threes as your opponents. And as a team, you shot 41% from three, which is great numbers even today. And that was right, that was before others embraced the three-point shot, averaging like 86, 87 a game. Okay, so how did it happen that you went to the CBA? Because I don't know if you remember, but this is right about the time of the, my dad was supposed to coach a team in the IBA, which was a six foot four and under league. And they were going to play at they were going to play at the Bren Center, and you were the first, I think the first overall pick of the draft. And Bo Jackson, by the way, was his last pick. I don't know if you remember that. And okay. So so you get done playing and what happens?
Well, you know, it's funny. Your dad, Coach Gottlieb, we meet at Coco's right next to the airport, and he's saying that we're starting the league, and I'm thinking, okay, that's great, but I want to make the NBA. But it was, this was going to give me a great opportunity to you know, keep playing. And I, at the time, they were offering, it was going to be a pretty good salary. I can't remember. I thought it was like $20,000 for like 3 months or 4 months, and it was 6'4 and under. It was very intriguing. And I was looking forward to, you know, if things don't work out, which, you know, there was a good chance they weren't going to work out initially, that I would have something to fall back on. Unfortunately, it didn't really take off in Irvine. But then I went to the Summer League in Los Angeles, and they had two divisions. They had a NBA division with all a lot of NBA teams, and their first, second, third-year players and guys that are trying to make a team. And then they had the free agent division, basically was saying, pay your $400. We're going to throw you on a team, and nobody's going to watch you. And we're going to tell you that everybody's scouting you. So we paid my $400. I was on a team. I was small forward on that team, and we were playing like at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning games where nobody was there other than your girlfriend or your parents in the stands. And but it gave me an opportunity to compete. But I stayed there all day, Doug. This is the thing that really made me. And I tell my kids, and I tell when I speak to kids, you can't expect anybody to give you anything, but you have to be ready to answer the call and be there and always be around. And so what I did, I got into my pickup truck with a sack lunch and got to the LMU like at 7 a.m. Beat the traffic to L.A. And I stayed there every single day, all day, and watching NBA practices. And coaches at that time, they needed players to participate in practice because guys were hurt and guys left. And so coaches would see me and ask me to play. So I practiced like for three or four different NBA teams. But the head of the head of the summer league saw me and
Larry Krieg,
and I think Coach Mitchell. But Larry, they offered me to be the starting guard on the All-Star team that was playing against the Russian national team and the Atlanta Hawks. They're kind of like a combo team. They were traveling around all the summer leagues to play. And that's how I got spotted. I played, and I played well. Doc Rivers, Bud Webb was on that team. And Marcelonis was on the team and a bunch of other players. I don't remember. But I played extremely well the next day. I got an offer to go to vet camp with the Detroit Pistons and Philadelphia 76ers, and that changed. That game alone changed my career, but it was because I stayed at the gym for like 10 straight days, and they saw that I was watching and waiting for my opportunity.
Wow, that's really okay. So, so this is your first year out of school. You play in the as back when the summer league was at LMU, as you point out. And you end up going to camp with the, you go to camp with the Sixers that year?
Yeah, I went to camp with the Sixers. I thought I played pretty good. Matt Gukas was the coach, but he thought otherwise. I didn't play well enough to even make an exhibition game. I was cut right before the first exhibition game, and I thought I played pretty well, but I did not. So back then, I don't know if they did it every team, but back then I go to practice, and the equipment manager, Alan Lumpkin, who is now like up there in the Sixer organization, and is actually his son, works with me now. He's one of our video guys. So what a great little side story there. But he calls me, he says, hey, Scott, you've just been cut. If you want to keep your practice gear, you can go ahead and keep it, but you got to go see, her name was Mary, the secretary, to get your flight out. I'm like thinking to myself, wow, that's how you get cut in the NBA? The coach doesn't even come up to you. The general manager doesn't come up to you. You just, equipment manager comes up to you, say, hey, go get your flight. And so I did. I go to the office. And as I'm leaving to jump on the van to go back to the airport, just so happened to be I crossed paths with the assistant coach, Jimmy Lynam. And he set me down for like 5 minutes and gave me the most inspirational pep talk I've ever had. He was basically telling me, I'm going to make the NBA. You just got to go to the CBA. You got to stick it out. You got to play the way you play. You got to continue to play with toughness. You will be back. And trust me, it will be sooner than you think. And so I went to the CBA and I played. I never got picked up. And
Hold on. Let's slow down because it's a great story. Okay. So you go to Albany. Was Albany your first choice? Was that your only choice? You go to play for Bill Musselman, who his son obviously is doing a great job as coach at Nevada. Yeah. He's been a head coach with the Sacramento Kings, been an assistant all over. And Bill Musselman is one of the original Fanatics. And who was also the head coach of the Timberwolves. Like, Bill Musselman was crazy. He was a great coach, but he was crazy. But for people who don't know, like, look, I mean this as a compliment. Like, you were a dick to play against. Like, you would want it, like, in a pickup game, and I was a kid, you would, in fact, light me up just to, and like, okay, so this we'll get to the story in a second, the pickup ball story, but was this always your persona? Was it established when Jimmy Lynam sat you down? It's like, look, you're going to make it, but you got to be kind of an a-hole to do it. Take me through, go ahead.
I'll tell you, I think a lot goes back to my childhood. I wouldn't change anything. I mean, I was definitely did not know that at that point. I did not know we had no money. I didn't know we were on welfare. I didn't know that nobody else was not living the same way we were living. There was not a lot of, there was not a lot of, I guess, wealth or not a lot of money in the whole entire area, but it made me. It gave me everything that I have in my belly to make it. I knew I was going to make it, and I refused to be pigeonholed in being called something that I knew that I was not. That wasn't me. I didn't want to be that way. So I always felt that I had to fight for everything. And I always felt, once you're in the competition, it's a fight. You do whatever it takes within the rules to win. And I refused to play any other way. And that's how I was brought up. And, like I said, my mom raised me that way. I fought. I've been in many fights. And I did a lot of things I should never did as a young kid. But it all changed. I go back to this eighth grade graduation, June 6, 1979. It changed. I told myself that night that I will be in the NBA and I will make something out of my life. And I'm not going to let anybody tell me anything different. And I've been told a lot. I've been told that you look like you're going to be checking groceries. You're going to be, driving UPS. Not that there's nothing wrong with that, but I felt that I was good enough to be an NBA player. I don't know how I got.
You glossed over that with your childhood. Like, that's a great, like, how in the, because I had the exact same kind of vision and dream, and I have it written down. My freshman year at Tustin High School, we had to get an apartment, and because I grew up in the El Medina district, and my brother, played some two. El Medina was kind of a nothing high school, like basically like Robbie Gordon was from there, and who was a race car driver, and outside of that, up until now, we're Freddie Freeman, who's an all-star baseball player. No one really came out of El Medina, and so especially basketball. So I stayed back in eighth grade. All I wanted to do was be a basketball player. My dad had my notebook, and he's like, I want you to write down your goals. And I wrote, I want to play in college basketball. I want to play in the Final Four. I want to play in the NBA. And then he was like, great, those are goals. Now, like, with the rest of the notebook, you're going to fill up with what you're going to do all the things you're going to do in order to get there. But like eighth grade without a dad, without kind of guidance, how did you come to the how did you come to your own mind that I'm going to play in the NBA no matter what anybody says?
Well, you know, like I said, it goes back. I've had great mentors along the way, and it goes back to my mom. I remember using the word, "I can't. I can't make the NBA." And she said, "What?" I said, "Well, I can't make the NBA. Those guys are like so much bigger than me and faster and athletic." And she said, "Okay, that's fine. See this? It was like 10 pieces of paper, you know, front and back, line paper." She said, "I want you to do me a favor and write on every line, front and back, all 10 pages, 'I can't is not a word.'" And so I had to do that, print it out. And she said, "I need it legible. I need it printed out neatly and take your time. It's not a rush thing." And I took to heart to that. And I really believe can't is not a word. If you make it a word, it's going to be pretty predominant in your life. But I refuse to look at that word and say that's going to be me. I'm not going to let that word define me. And I just felt that, you know what? Everybody has to put on the shoes the same way, the shorts the same way. Why can't I put on it the same way as an NBA player does? And I just felt that, you know, I have to earn it. Nobody was going to give it to me. I have to exhaust every opportunity and physically and mentally challenge myself every day. And that just goes back, you know, going into CBA, Musselman. Coach Musselman challenged you not only physically, he challenged you mentally. There's a line you got to cross as a coach, and now that I know, you try to cross that, and you try to cross the physical line occasionally, and then you got to go to the mental line. Some days you got to do both. But Musselman, he did both every day as if it was game seven of an NBA finals, and he treated everybody that way. And it really molded me. I really give him a lot of credit, man. I remember one game, I twisted my ankle so bad. Against this really good guard. He's like a CBA legend. His name was Boot Bond. What a great name. And he was, I mean, good player. And I'm 22 years old. I twisted my ankle so bad. This thing blew up like a balloon. And I remember leaving in the second quarter, going downstairs in the old armory, and I had to use the restroom so bad. And back then, you used the restroom with the fans, and it was like using a urinal, and then the fans were looking at me and say, hey, Scott, good game, man. I hope you're all right. I hope you're back for the second half. So I go in the locker room. We have no trainer there. So I'm looking at my ankle. Oh, my gosh, what am I going to do? So at halftime, like the fire chief comes in, and, you know, he's basically like also the trainer. I think his name is Jack. So he comes in, looks at my ankle. He said, "No, there's no way. There's absolutely 100%. There's no way you can play." So Coach Musselman is doing his talk, and he just glossed over me. And he said, "Scott, you all right?" I said, "I'm like at that point, I'm like stuttering, like I don't know. I'm nervous because he's about to scream at me. I'm like, I don't." And then he said, "Okay, I'll tell you what. If you can't play, make sure you go to our secretary tomorrow morning and get a flight back to California." And I'm like, "What?" I said, no, I'm good, Coach. I'm good. I can play." So I tied that thing up so tight and ended up playing in the second half. To this day, I don't know how I played. I wish I can somehow get videotape of that because I was dragging that leg all around, but I didn't want to get cut. I know this is my chance, and I cannot let it be blown away with just a twisted ankle.
All right, so did you guys get married? Were you guys married at this point?
No, we were not married, but we were, I mean, it was going that direction. My wife and I, at that time, my girlfriend and I, it was somebody that I knew that I want to spend the rest of my life with. But it was, she came out and stayed with me in Albany. And at that time, my first contract in Albany was a 1-year non-guaranteed day to day with Musselman. No. Play-to-play contract, every possession to possession.
Wait, but how much?
$6,600.
And then did you guys get per diem?
Per diem was probably, per diem basically was just enough money to go to you went to Sizzlers because they had all-you-can-eat lunch, and you ended up staying there.
Take some home with you.
Dinner, and then take some home with you.
Yeah. Yeah, or we did this in high school, and I did it when I was in the U.S. When I was in the USBL, we would do it too. We'd have like $20 a day. when I was in the ABA, it was $20 a day as well. And we do the sizzler thing, or then we do, you know, like one dude would pay and other guys would sit at the table in order to save money. So you get done, you're on the all rookie team. Didn't you go play in like Fresno and some other random league?
Yes, it ended up being the WBL, the league that your dad was going to be a part of. I don't think it actually made it, or they maybe merged with the WBL, the World Basketball League. It was the same concept, 6'4" and under. And I was playing with the Fresno team, played there all year, all summer. It was like a 50-game, 54-game, three months in the summer league. And it was funny that the same guys that I was playing in the CBA, that they were listed as 6'9", and they trying to make an NBA team. Somehow, some way, they shrunk to 6'4" in the summer to play in this 6'4" and under league. You had to do it. I mean, there was no money in the CBA, and that league paid $20,000 per player. I think every player got the same amount of money.
In a shocking development, that league did not stay around all that long. Then how'd you make the Sixers the next year? Did you go back through the summer league thing, or no? You're playing in the WBL, so there was no summer league.
There was no summer league, but Jimmy Lynam ends up taking over for Matty Gukas for Philadelphia, becomes the head coach, and so he calls me up, and coincidental, Detroit calls me up. The same two teams that wanted to bring me in last year, so. He calls me up, and you know he said they're looking for a backup point guard. They got Mo Cheeks as a starter, and Gerald Henderson, which is like a combo guard. David Wingate, and they're thinking about some other guys overseas. And I say, okay, that's great. But Detroit calls me up. Jack Kleski was the general manager. He calls me up. He says Isaiah Thomas, Joe Dumars, and Vinnie Johnson were the guards, and they're looking for a backup point guard. And it's going to be between Mike Williams from Baylor and myself. And we were going to go in both with the same non-guarantee contract, 1 year, like non-guarantee for like $75,000. I said, great. So I committed to him. I said, perfect. I know, you know, just give me a chance and I'm going to do my best. And that's all I wanted. So I felt that they were going to give me a great opportunity to be a backup to Isaiah. So Jimmy Lynam ends up calling me. He says, Scott, no, they're not telling you. They're not being upfront with you. It's not going to be an even deal. Mike Williams has like a 3-year guaranteed at like $300,000 a year for like $900,000. And I'm like, well, no, I talked to them. My agent talked to them. They said no. So I went back and forth. But finally, Jimmy calls me once again, like the night before I was going to fly out. He said, Scott, I'm going to tell you this, and I probably shouldn't tell you this, but I'm going to tell you it just like if I was your dad, I would tell you, do not go there. Come to Philadelphia. I'm not guaranteeing you a spot, but you have a chance. Detroit, you have no chance. They're not going to cut a player that's going to be guaranteed for 3 years. Not going to do it. So I said, okay, perfect. I'm there. Flew out the next day, went to Philadelphia. Fast forward during training camp, I'd have a great training camp, play well in exhibition. Backing up Maurice Cheeks, pressuring him up and down the court. He's doing the same to me. We're not backing down from each other. They liked what they saw, and they offered me the job. So I ended up making the team, but it was because of Jimmy Lynam showed and gave me great advice. I mean, he was more than a coach and still is more than a coach to this day, but thankful for him, he made that last call to tell me, do not go there. There's no chance to make the team there.
Okay, so here's what if you can kind of shake your memory, what was the call like, or what was the office visit like when they told you they were keeping you?
Well, this is interesting. I had a non-guaranteed like $75,000, and it wasn't going to be guaranteed until like December 23rd. That was the guaranteed date. Thank goodness they changed that to like January 10th, because there's a lot of unhappy families right around that time because you were going to get cut because they didn't want to guarantee the year. But I get the call from John Nash. He calls me and he says, come down to the office. And the office was like right under the old Eagles football stadium. And so I go to the office, and, you know, as a 23-year-old kid, it's intimidating. So I go into his office. I mean, it's big desk, wood desk. I'm sure, you know, high-end mahogany or cherry or whatever walnut wood. But it was like, I still remember that desk, and it was like John Nash was on the other side of shaking. So I'm thinking, okay, I think I'm going to make the team. They kind of told me I was on the team. Barclays told me I was on the team, but now the general manager's talking to me. So he says, hey, you're going to make the team. Congratulations, but here's what we want to do. We want to give you, we want to rip up your contract and give you a new contract. And I'm like, what? This is like way too good to be true. So he says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to guarantee you $25,000 this year and then give you like $100,000 next year, non-guaranteed. And he says, just sign this. And I said, well, I said, I'm not comfortable signing it. And he's kind of like taken back, and he's like startled. He said, well, wait a minute, what do you mean? He said, you need to call your agent. He said, but I'll leave the room, call your agent. So I end up calling my agent, Frank Catapano. I give him the scenario and what just took place. And he says, well, you need to sign it. I said, because that's 25 guarantee. You know, some teams, they don't take that lightly. They'll end up give you the benefit of the doubt to keep you. I said, well, Frank, I just don't want to commit to him for 2 years. Next year is non-guaranteed. And I said, I don't feel comfortable. I just stay with my normal contract. If I'm good enough to make it, I'm going to stay on the team. If I'm not, I'm not going to be on the team. It's simple in my eyes. I was real black and white. It was either I'm on it or I'm not. Just, you know, let me know. So I called Mr. Nash back in, and I tell him what I'm going to do, and he says, wow, are you sure? He says, we're looking at a guy that is playing overseas right now, but we're going to bring him in. I think, if I can remember the name, I think it was Dave Henderson, played at Duke. And he says, he's really a good guard. He's a combo guard. He can play a little bit of point. He's 6'5", and, you know, we're going to guarantee him like $50,000, and I don't know, you might not be able to, you know, match that if you don't play well enough. You sure you don't want to sign this? I said, no. And I looked him right in the eye. I said, if he deserves to make the team over me, I think he should be on the team over me. I said, I don't deserve to be on the team, but I'm very comfortable with my contract, and I'm very happy with the opportunity I'm given. I shook his hand, and immediately it was like the funny. We still laugh at this all the time when we see each other. He shook my hand. He just said, you know what, Scott? You just made yourself a lot of money. Congratulations. And then I walked out and ended up playing, over a decade.
Okay, but wait, you also, that year you started 6 games. So among the things, like, look, everybody dreams of playing in the playoffs and winning a championship. And even, you know, my whole dream was like, look, all I really wanted was to play one game in the NBA. But to have your name announced, and remember, this is the Sixers. You guys not only had Mo Cheeks, but yeah, this is Barkley in the height of Barkley's powers. This is 25 a game. People forget that Chuck, and I want to ask you about Chuck in a minute, about how he was a freak athlete. Like, everybody thinks just roly-poly, round mound, and rebound, but he was an incredible athlete. But anyway, do you remember what it was like the first time your name is called starting point guard for the Philadelphia 76ers, Scottie Brooks?
Oh, my gosh. I remember it, and it was just, you know, everybody in my position, all I want to do is just get in a warm-up game or a preseason game and get in just playing a game and just be able to do that. You know, I played for over a decade in the NBA, and I only started 6 games. And I don't know if I was unlucky that I only started 6 games, but I look at it, some people say I was unlucky because, you know, sooner or later, a starting point guard is going to get hurt for a month or two, and he's going to, you know, you're going to get an opportunity to start. But I never looked at it that way. I looked at it, I was on the team, and I was always about the team. But when I started, it was such a surreal moment. I don't know what we ended up being. I think we were 5-1 or 4-2. And I ended up playing a lot the game before that because Murray Cheeks, I think he separated his shoulder a little bit. So I played the game before that. But playing along with Barkley, I mean, we can go days. This podcast can last for an hour straight just talking about him. But what an amazing teammate and person that I'm so fortunate to be able to call a teammate for 2 seasons.
What about him? What do people not know about Charles Barkley that you know?
The most generous person, the most giving I've person I've ever been around. I mean, constantly. And he was known, rightfully so, as a, you know, a tough guy, a badass. And he had this way about him that, you know, you don't mess with him. He was strong. He was quick. He was athletic. He was a freak of nature. I mean, he was 6'5", maybe, 255, 260 on good days, but extremely gifted in athleticism and brains. He just had a high IQ. But people don't realize that he was always giving, man. He was always. I mean, there's so many stories that just constantly. I played golf with him one day, and that was a treat. I mean, just to see him play in person, it was like so like strange because so athletic he is, and then he can't play golf. But he loved it, and it didn't even bother him that he wasn't very good. When he's on the golf course, for some reason, the whole community finds out. And I don't know if it's the starter. I don't know if it's the range guy. I don't know if it's the pro shot. We just finished 9, and we're about turning the corner. And I would say there was 125 kids waiting for us, for Charles, just so happened to be in his cart. And he spent, I don't know, 35 minutes talking to these kids about education, about doing the right things, about playing the right way. And I'm just thinking to myself, I want to keep kicking your butt, so let's get to number 10. But I wanted to just stay in the moment because this guy was just like spewing out just great information and tidbit. But as a young player, for me to see that, to see him give back to the community, it was great to see. What a great role model for me. And it's funny, he has the commercial, I'm not a role model, but he was a great role model for me. He did crazy things. He did dumb things that he would regret like we all do. But, you know, but he had a heart of a champion and a heart of, you know, like I've never seen a player have.
That your first year, you guys lost to the Bulls in 5 games. And when I was getting ready, when you say you do this with me, I wanted to look up some stuff. And this was Michael Jordan's. Barkley had 20 rebounds, 19 rebounds, 20 rebounds, 13, 13. Jordan had 39, 45, 49, 45, and 37. What was Michael Jordan like to be on the other side?
You know, and that's crazy. And I swear he only scored in the first 8 minutes and the last 8 minutes. It just seems like he was, you know, just, you know, offensively just filling out the game in the middle part of the game. But start the game, he set the tone, and obviously he finished the game. Incredible. I mean, you can argue he's the best player, and some people don't think of an argument. The guy was the best offensive player and the best defensive player, all in the same, and he was that way for over a decade. I guess he could easily have been MVP every single year. I mean, what's an off year from him? Okay, he averaged 29 this year instead of 33. But he had shots that you didn't make him miss. He missed. It was him. He elevated way over you. He was stronger than most guys, 6'6", 210, or whatever, how many pounds he weighs. He just had this wiry strength. And, you know, as being a point guard against him, you got Scottie Pippen denying on the left side, and you got Michael Jordan denying on the right side. And that's hard to make those just simple, you know, passes to the right or left that you are always like, okay, I see him. I know he's going to steal it. And he steals it. But just incredible just to be on that court. That playoff series to me was watching greatness. And I don't know if anybody's had those type of moments that many games so consistently as he played that series.
Okay, so what was, if you had to pick out the flaw to Barkley, because I think Barkley now, you know, there's some people say, you know, some guys' games, I don't know how some of the bigs would translate to now. Barkley, I think, would translate now because athletically, especially in his prime, he could guard all those positions. But did he? Like, the knock on Barkley I had always heard was, like, he never was really bought into defense as good. And he, even though he could be, he's a great rebounder and obviously a phenomenal scorer. Was it his defense? Was it his shooting? What was it that held Chuck back from being just that notch below?
Well, you know, to me, there's so many opinions and knocks, you know, about Charles' defense and this and that. The biggest knock, that he was playing in the East against Jordan. And there was a lot of, and then prior to that, it was Boston. there's a lot of good teams, and you know, there's a lot of great players that couldn't get by them, just like the East now. You know, with LeBron 8 straight years, it's some guys that you just can't get by, and Jordan, you couldn't get by him. He was dominant. But
I mean, if I would say one thing on the court, I mean, rim protector. He wasn't. I mean, 6'5".
Yeah,
he's gonna do. He competed. I don't think we never had the defensive inside presence that I think you need, especially back in the late 80s or 80s and 90s, where, you know, defense for sure wins championships, and it was, you had to protect the paint, you got to protect, and you were basically playing football back then. So that was a knock on him, but I'll tell you, he rebounded better than any player in the league, and he can score on any over any big in the league. And He had a great sense of the floor. He had a great eye for passing, and he always made some great decisions. And like I said, I thoroughly enjoyed every game playing with him. And I happened to have lived with him for 2 months and at his house, and that was also an interesting
I feel like we're burying the lead. Why did you live with Charles Barkley?
Well, you know what? I thought he was just being a nice guy. I thought he was being really generous, which he is. I'm like, man, this guy's cool. He's invited me over. I'm living with him. And I stayed there till about December, I don't know, 24th.
But how'd the conversation go that you came to live with Barkley?
Well, it was not even a conversation. He said, "You're living with me." I'm like, okay, great. So I remember back then they had these like phone cards. Like 1-800, whatever it was, and
how
you made long distance calls. So I'm calling my mom. I said, "You're not going to believe this. Not only am I going to make the team, I'm going to live with Charles Barkley." And she says, "Uh-oh, you want that? That's like an interesting guy to be under his wing." But I said, "No, we want it. You're great." So I live with him. It was like no choice. But as it turns out, and this was even makes the story even better. I was about to sign a lease, and for some reason I can remember these apartments, like Lincoln Green Apartments, right on City Line Avenue in Ballycan Wood area in Philadelphia, right behind the Fridays. I was about to sign the lease for like 6 months, and once you sign a lease, you're stuck with it. So Charles knew that I had a great chance not to stick past the December 23rd deadline. So he did not want me to commit to a lease and sign for 6 months and be stuck with it for, you know, 4.5-5 months after they cut me. So, but he never told me that until after, and I can remember. And only he can say in these colorful ways, and I cannot tell you or say it over this interview. But basically, in a PG version, you knucklehead, you think I really wanted to have this California kid live with me, 23 years old, in my house? No, I did it because I didn't want you to pay $1,000 a month for 6 straight months because I knew you weren't going to make the team. Well, that's why I brought you in. But what a great guy. What a great story. What a great roommate. My God, we had the time of my life, and he loved to go out, and he loved to have fun, and he's so good with the public. I've never seen a superstar so generous with his time with the public. I mean, dinner, come up to us. I mean, it was almost like
he's amazing.
They might as well just sit with us. Amazing.
I worked with him when I was at CBS, and you know, even now that we don't work together, like anytime with him, like, "Dougie, you're coming with me," and it's kind of the same thing. And you're just my wife. Here's my story with Chuck. So the first Final Four I do with him, you know, we worked together one weekend in studio, and we had kind of a mutual friend. And I knew him a little bit, and then I name dropped you, like, "Yeah, I grew up, you know, in the shadow of Scotty Brooks," and so automatically I was good with him. And so we go to the Final Four, and it's in Atlanta, and he has a place. It's like a condo in the Four Seasons in Atlanta. It's like a condo for when he works at Turner, and it's right across from Turner.
Oh yeah.
So we get done at the George Dome, and the Turner guys, they don't meet. They're like, we're not meeting. And so I work for CBS, even though it was a Turner type broadcast. So they're like, "Well, they're not, they don't have, Kenny does and Charles doesn't have to be here, but you and Clark and Greg Anthony's with us this time. You guys need to be here like 9 o'clock. And the games don't start until, you know, like the afternoon." So we're literally at the dome all day. So we get done, then we do like an hour and a half or 2 hour post game, and I'm wrecked. You know, it's like I'm a little on edge. It's my first Final Four, plus I'm working with Charles Barkley, and so I get done, and it's like 11. He's like, "Hey, you and your wife, you're coming out with us." And I was like, "Oh, okay, that's great." So we go, and we're like, they have town cars for us. And he like tells the town car guy, like, you're not allowed to take them to their hotel. Bring them to the Four Seasons at the bar. So we're like, all right, we're going out with Charles Barkley. You know, and the idea, like, how many times in your life is Charles Barkley going to demand you go out with him? So we go to the Four Seasons, and my wife is not much of a drinker, but she was, I don't know, Charles picks up everybody's tab literally. And so he says, "Young lady, what would you like?" And she's like, I'm fine, Chuck. I already have a drink. He said, No. What's your favorite drink in the whole world?" And so I said, "Chuck, she grew up in a trailer, but she has high dollar taste. She likes champagne." And he's like, "No problem. What is your favorite champagne?" And she's just like, I'll take whatever. Don't worry about it." I was like, "That's not being honest." So we had a. We had a friend who, Cristal. We had a friend who, they would send us a bottle of Cristal every year, and she and I would have it like our anniversary. I was like, "She likes Cristal." He's like, "No problem." He's like, "Cristal for the lady." So we're having Cristal, and you know, it's like 1 o'clock or 1:30. They shut down the bar. And so Angie and I were like looking at our watches, and we don't have no kids with us. And so he's like, "All right, we're going upstairs." So now everybody goes up to his apartment. And so we've been there for a couple of hours. We've been talking. He walks into the door. He walks right to the refrigerator. And remember, there's like 40 people in this traveling circus following around Charles Barkley. And he goes right to the fridge, and he goes and he gets a bottle of Cristal and hands it to my wife. And he says, "I know this is your favorite. Have as much as you'd like. You know, we got more where that came from." Like, that's just, he's unbelievable. Oh, and like, there's, and you know how it is, like when he's sitting there, you not only are 30, 40 people going up with him, but there's hundreds of people stopping by, taking pictures, shaking hands, whatever. You know, he probably went through meeting 500 people in the last couple of hours. And yet his first thought when he walks in the door was, "This guy I've worked with once, I'm going to get his wife a bottle of champagne because I know that's the one he likes." I've never experienced anything like that.
And you know what? It's all the time. I can say every day. He would make more money than he will ever need if he just had a reality show follow him or cameras follow him every single day. The guy is such a people person. I mean, there's thousands of stories of my friends say, "Hey, I'm friends with Scott Brooks." All of a sudden, they're hanging with him for 3 straight hours. And they can't believe it. I said, "Well, he's like that with everyone." I remember the first time we played the Lakers, we fly from Philadelphia to play the Lakers, and all of my college teammates, they could not wait. I mean, for obvious reasons, I'm playing on the Sixers, and we're playing against Lakers, and you got Magic Johnson, you got Jabbar, you got Worthy, Kurt Rambis, Myron Scott, all these great players, and we're playing. And so I go upstairs, shower and they get dressed to meet all my buddies in the lobby. So it's like, 30 minutes later or so, they're already hanging with Charles. And then, and the next thing I know, I walk down and now Charles and they are having, like, back then WWF was like our WWE, whatever the wrestling thing was. It was huge back then. So they are having in the middle of the hotel lobby, like a wrestling matches with all my college teammates and Barkley. They're like wrestling each other. I'm like, "What are you guys doing?" He said, "Nah, we just started talking trash and we were drinking beers, and all of a sudden we said, 'I'm the best wrestler.' And all of a sudden Charles said, 'I'm the best.'" And he starts wrestling with some of my college teammates. I mean, the guy is so fun to be around. Love him. Love him.
Okay. So then you go to Houston. Your second year, you guys won the championship. What was Dream like?
You know what? Incredible. I swear he didn't miss a shot in the entire fourth quarter of every game the year we won it in 94. Just incredible. He had so much confidence, so much faith in his teammates. He put you in your place. He wanted you to keep it simple. And simple with him was, "Give me the ball." And it was so simple, but it was so effective. That's why I played a lot in the fourth quarter, because we threw the ball into him, and I was smart enough, you know what? We want an offense, we'll give it to him. And he said, throw the ball to me. I score. If they double-team me, I pass, you get an open shot.
Yeah.
If they don't, I score or get one, get a man one, I get free throws. Easy game. Let's keep it easy. We don't have to do anything else. And we did that. I mean, he can – that guy, I swear, he never fell. He had like the – he's like a cat. He had such great balance. He's like a, almost like a guy that was 6'1", but 7 feet tall. He had that much agility and athleticism and just a great teammate. Just like when he spoke and wasn't often, it was like E.F. Hutton. You stopped whatever you did and you listened, because when he was speaking – you knew either you did something wrong or something incredible is about to happen. And he stepped up every single night.
What's that feeling like of winning a championship? You didn't get to win one in junior college, as you point out. You didn't win one in high school. You didn't get the NCAA tournament, win a PCAA even when you're at UC Irvine. You guys didn't, you know, you couldn't get past the Bulls with the Sixers. You go to the Rockets in your second year. You win a championship. You win an NBA championship. Considering all the people that had told you you wouldn't make it since eighth grade, now you had made it, you'd started games, you'd stuck, you're an NBA veteran, but to win a championship, what's that like?
Doug, nothing like it. You play competitive sports to be the last team standing, and I've never been in that position. And it's very difficult. You know, you see some of these players that won multiple championships. I mean, they are so blessed and lucky to be on a team that good. But I was on that team that good to win 1 year. And to this day, I have a picture after the game 7 in Houston. We're at this restaurant, and it's a picture of my wife and I with the championship hat on. She's not a big drinker. I'm not a big drinker, but we were having some champagne, and you can see in my eyes that I was feeling pretty good. But to this day, I have it on my desk at home, and I pass by it all the time, and it just gives me great memories. It's something that, you know, you strive to be, and you want to be the best team. Nobody can ever. I mean, obviously, I wasn't even near the best player in the league, on the team, or whatever, you know, but I was on the best team in 1994, and they can never take that away from me. And it's something that I will always cherish. And what a great experience to be the first team ever of all the major sports in Houston to win a championship. That team really, that city just took us in like I've never been taken in before. What a great time. I mean, I want to get back there. I was there pretty close as a coach with Oklahoma, but not quite. But it would be a great honor and an opportunity to get back there again.
Okay, so after you got done, so you know, you got traded to Dallas, right? Mid-year the following year, so you didn't play in the back-to-back, correct?
Not only mid-year, but mid-game at halftime. That was
Wait, what?
Yeah, at halftime we were playing at halftime. The day the trade deadline back then was like, I don't know, it was like, let's just say 8 o'clock Eastern time. And so there's, you know, every trade deadline of players thinking, okay, this could be the day I'm getting traded. But I remember I was told that day, don't worry about it, you're not getting traded, because my name was thrown out there, because Sam Cassell came on, and he was obviously really, really, really a good player and deserved to play over me. But I knew that I had a chance, but they told me that day that I wasn't getting traded. So during the game, after the first quarter, middle of the second quarter, I look up to my wife, and she's in the stands right behind her bench. She gives me a thumbs up, and I give her a thumbs up, meaning that, you know, we survived another year of not being traded, been there before, and we really loved Houston. We just bought a house, you know, the year before, just, you know, at home. It was a home away from home. So I get into halftime, Rudy Tomjanovich and all the assistant coaches do make all their great adjustments that he is known to do. And I'm thinking, okay, great. So I'm now back on the court in the layup line. And next thing I know, the general manager, Bob Reinhardt, calls me out of the line and says, hey, we've got to talk to you. Takes me through the tunnel. And right at the tunnel, he says, hey, you just been traded. And I'm like, what? He said, yeah, we just traded you. So he tells me I'm traded to Dallas. I think I was traded for like a second-round pick and Morgan Wiley, and I was upset. I mean, I was pissed because I didn't want to get traded. I felt that, you know, I was told that I was not going to get traded, but as it turns out, you know what, I was undrafted, did not make it as a drafted player. So the way I looked at the silver lining, it was after a while I looked at it. Now I'm traded for two players, a pick and a live player. So what a career, but what a way to get traded during the game. It wasn't a lot of fun.
No, that's really, really remarkable. And, you know, like, look, we glossed over the Minnesota. Even when you go to Dallas, that was back when you had, when it was the Jim Jackson, Jamal Mashburn, Jason Kidd, like three unbelievable talents who ultimately that thing broke up.
Yes. Coach Mata had a good term. You know, we had, there was only the three J's. And he said they were really good, really young, and really going to be a team to be, you know, reckon with Jimmy Jackson, Jason Kidd, and Jamal. That was three very highly, highly skilled, very competitive. He said, but the fourth J took over the team, and that was jealousy. And it was unfortunate that we just could not get along and figure out a good balance of sharing the pie, like I would like to say. Because when you're a young player, you want it all. But if you want to be a good young player, and that's the thing that I give a lot of credit to Westbrook and Durant, that they were willing to share the pie to being such great players that they were.
All right, so let's get to that, because you start out, you're a player coach with the LA Stars and the ABA, right? Then with the Southern California Surf, right? Was there ever a moment to which your wife pulls you aside and says, like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? What was her sense when you started coaching?
Well, I waited a year or two because I wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to put my family through the traveling, moving city to city as I did as a player. But I wanted them to be committed to it because I didn't want to go in and then not go full steam ahead and trying to become a head coach. And so I waited, and we got, you know, I listened to my wife, obviously, quite a bit, as most husbands do. So she said, let's do it. I'm willing to move from city to city, and let's do it. It's going to be a great experience, as long as we can do it together as a family. And your kids move from school to school, it's not easy. Definitely not easy. It's a lot of tough times. But when you do it together and you can get through it together, you're going to come out better and stronger. And I think that's one of the reasons why I think my kids are really well-rounded and versed in a lot of different situations, because they were put in different situations. But it wasn't easy. The minor league's not easy. I remember driving the van. I remember setting the times for gym times. I remember passing out tickets. I remember, and this was the most incredible thing, I remember taping guys' ankles, and I just did it off of memory when watching trainers tape my ankles. So
yeah, figure eight, right?
I was everything. And when, yeah, in the minor leagues, you had to do that back then. But now, being in the minor leagues, now the G League is now, these players don't realize how good they have it. I hope they do. I mean, I don't know if they do or not, but back in the minor leagues back then, it was really tough to be a minor league player.
That's it for part one of my discussion with Scotty Brooks, head coach of the Washington Wizards, about his journey to make it to the NBA. Upcoming next week in the All Ball podcast, I'll have more with Scotty Brooks. We'll talk about what it was like to coach those Thunder. We'll talk about what he sees as the ultimate ceiling for the Washington Wizards. I'm also going to ask him about that terrible picture that John Wall took when he was practicing with Team USA. Make sure you download, subscribe, and rate the All Ball podcast. Don't forget to download and listen to my radio show daily on Fox Sports Radio, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific. If you have any questions, feel free to hit me on Twitter, on Instagram, or on our Facebook page. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this has been All Ball.